Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, live today from KUVO Jazz 89 Public Radio in Denver, Colorado, where something important happened in the last 24 hours, or was that in Charlotte, North Carolina? Hey, both places have The Takeaway broadcast each day, and thanks so much for listening. But this Super Bowl between the Broncos and the Carolina Panthers is going to be all in the family. More about that later in the program. It was a grim winter weekend for millions of Americans, though. Washington, D.C., shuttered by snow and ice. More than a dozen fatalities from this storm. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick found his neighbor, Carlos Machado, trying to shovel his walk yesterday for the first time.
Never seen anything like this. So I grew up in a different country, so it's like we're in a tropical in Colombia. So it's like we never see these kinds of things, you know. It's actually the first year I buy one of these ever in my life. I'm 47, so the first shovel I ever had.
For me, though, who's seen a few snowflakes in my life, getting out to Denver yesterday meant a crawl through the Arctic snow canyons of South Brooklyn at 5 a.m., where the streets were iced by some record-high tides. Then across a snow-encrusted, slow-going Brooklyn Bridge, I made it to a deserted Manhattan, but for some police cars enforcing a travel ban, they let us by. Then a train out of the storm madness north to Boston, where I boarded a plane emblematic of another kind of madness. People wearing New England Patriots jerseys, sitting next to people decked out in orange Broncos regalia, and for 4 hours it was howling and clapping, and one more round of drinks, please. And when I got to mild Denver, it was a city in orange crush football celebration.
Ah, this is so great. Tom Brady's never going to face a challenge like this. Run!
I'm going to the Super Bowl, baby. With or without a ticket, I'll be there.
NFL aside, though, this is a good place to think about innovation and its place in American history. We are going to be talking about that this hour with two people from the University of Colorado who are living it. And we're also launching a Takeaway Greatest Innovation series that you can be a part of, nominating that innovation, that thing, that invention that you believe changed everything. Stay with us for that. But we begin talking about the prospect that everything may be changing in the presidential race before a vote is cast. The former mayor of New York City, Michael Bloomberg, is reportedly exploring the possibility of a third-party candidacy. That's the latest twist that, in theory, shakes up all the numbers. Michael Remlett, co-founder and CEO of Morning Consult, a technology company and public opinion polling firm based in Washington, D.C., says his data from last week show that from a solid beginning number of poll support, Bloomberg can actually build by, as Remlett says, filling a blank canvas out there of voter ignorance about who exactly Michael Bloomberg actually is.
I think what's most startling is just how many people don't know or have an opinion of Michael Bloomberg. I think, for instance, to New Yorkers, he's very well known. To media or financial services community is very well known, but 43% of Americans don't know or have an opinion of him, and that would play out huge in this race. You compare that with Clinton or with Trump, only 4% of Americans don't know or have an opinion of Hillary Clinton, only 6% of Americans don't know or have an opinion of Donald Trump.
Does the fact that Michael Bloomberg has way more billions than Donald Trump, is that important to anyone? Did you measure that? Is it even knowable?
I don't know if it's important to voters, and certainly the way they talk about it is going to be important. You look at Donald Trump, the way he talks about his billions, you know, it's a source of pride in those pieces. When you look at sort of how the campaign played out with Mitt Romney last cycle, it was a little bit different. So I think the way that the billions come into play is he's certainly demonstrated, and by he, Michael Bloomberg has certainly demonstrated that he's willing to spend money in a political context, whether it's in the mayoral races or most recently in a lot of the outside issue campaigns he's run. If he's willing to spend that money, he can address the fact that 43% of Americans don't necessarily know him And in fact, those who do know him right now, he actually has the highest net favorables. So 30% of Americans have a favorable opinion of him versus 26% who have an unfavorable. That's compared to Clinton, who's minus 12% negative net favorable among those that have opinion of her, and Donald Trump, who's minus 10.
If you were someone with $1 billion to spend, and apparently Bloomberg has alleged that he will spend as much as $1 billion on this campaign, is this about winning it all, or is this about denying the race to someone in particular? Looking at the numbers, where do you think that billion is best spent, Michael?
I think the billion, to put it into context, isn't that much money in national campaigns at this point. A billion just makes you competitive. It doesn't necessarily dwarf the field. And I think where you're likely to see that money spent, you know, for better or worse, is still on TV. And there's a lot of talk, certainly inside of Washington, D.C., in political circles about, you know, is TV losing its effectiveness? But at the end of the day, that's where most of the money has been spent in this campaign. And I think that what you have in Bloomberg is this unique third-party candidate. Typically, you have kind of the Ross Perot-like figure, but Bloomberg's held major office, and he has kind of this standing not only in the business, media, financial circles, but as well as in the broader context as having been the New York mayor.
Would you advise him, Mayor Bloomberg, you can't win, but you can make Trump a very miserable person, or you can win, and here's how? What's your analysis? What's your advice?
You know, I think the challenge for me being in that Morning Consult is a nonpartisan media and technology company. But if I were to look at this race, I think that it's impossible to say that he couldn't win. I think that what you find is out of the gate, he starts at 12%. When Trump entered the race, he didn't start at 12% among the Republican field. There's certainly a window. It's a unique year. The Americans are yearning for a change of pace, potentially somebody who's not affiliated with one of the two parties. So I think that if you look at this race, the only thing you can say, and certainly the last 12 months have bore this out, anything's possible.
Anything's possible. Very, 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 very safe. But it is really interesting, though, that we've got in what you looked at, the four candidates that you looked at, we've got the classic ideologue, leftist ideologue in Bernie Sanders. We've got the it's my turn, Hillary Clinton. We've got Donald Trump, the demagogue, you know, from the William Jennings Bryan era. And then you've got this do good, give back to America, Michael Bloomberg. I mean, it's suddenly not an obscure race, but a really complete race, looking at personalities who have run for president in the past in American history.
Absolutely. And it almost reflects the Congress itself. I mean, you have all these divisive personalities, you have different perspectives, you have some moderates, you have certainly some more ideologue-oriented members. And I think what's interesting here, too, and something we haven't talked about, is that if the race splintered this way, it really comes down to the Electoral College. Otherwise, it would likely move to the House of Representatives. And we have a whole different ballgame. And that's where the party structures really come into play. So even if Bloomberg won just a percentage more than Clinton or Trump, it's not necessarily the case that he would become president.
From your perspective, why is this so much fun?
I think that this is one of the most unique elections, in large part because the way in which media and technology have changed. I think what you're finding is that the barriers to running for president have never been smaller. And certainly Donald Trump has shown that.
Well, innovation in political consulting means there's a much bigger window all of a sudden with all this big data technology available. Michael Ramlett, thanks so much.
You bet. Thanks for having me, John.
Michael Ramlett is co-founder and CEO of Morning Consult, a technology company with a newsroom and public opinion polling firm based in Washington, D.C. Staying with presidential politics for the moment, it was a test of non-governance how Washington, D.C. couldn't have more completely shut down this weekend than if an army of debt ceiling busters descended from the sky instead of winter snow. But up I-95 in New Jersey, it was a much noisier test of governing and government response to a disaster as New Jersey governor and presidential candidate Chris Christie suspended his campaign to become first responder in chief over the weekend. The blizzard caused power outages and significant flooding along the Jersey shore, but the governor was able to get back to New Hampshire Sunday morning to continue his campaigning and note on CNN that it would be wrong to make too much of any connection between this storm and 2012's Hurricane Sandy. Matt Katz, reporter for our partner WNYC, was this a test of governing for the back-in-the-pack candidate?
It was, because he wasn't not campaigning. He got a chance to do several national TV interviews, which were ostensibly about storm recovery and how he was leading the state and giving a status update to places like CNN on what was going on down the Jersey Shore. But he was inevitably asked about the presidential campaign, and he was able to get some digs in on people like Marco Rubio while he was on TV doing technically storm response.
And of course, the echo here is of the 2012 Sandy event, which propelled him, you know, beyond his status as a national political figure. How do you think that echo is playing?
I mean, he brought it up as soon as he got back to New Hampshire. He's been using Sandy as the reason why New Hampshire voters, New Hampshire is really where he's centering his campaign, why New Hampshire voters should select someone like himself, a governor who is led, rather than a senator who he says doesn't do anything. And he said, after he got back from the storm, he said, I think New Jersey saw what strong, effective leadership is. He made a connection between how a governor like himself, who can lead folks through a storm, it means that they can lead them through Islamic radical terrorism. The argument for his presidency has come down so many times to Sandy. So the fact that he was able to go out there and kind of do the same thing again on a smaller scale allowed him to echo that same message. Whether it makes a difference in New Hampshire, I don't know. I don't know how impressed folks up in New Hampshire are about a governor who can, you know, handle a couple feet of snow.
Matt Katz, does Chris Christie have a long game here, or is New Hampshire and Iowa, to a lesser extent, must win for him? Is this kind of a last chance, given this storm and the benefit that it may have presented for Chris Christie? Is this his last moment?
Neither state is must win. The plan is this. The plan is that he has to beat the governors, the other governors in the race, particularly in New Hampshire. That means he can even come into fourth place in New Hampshire and he'll be okay with it, and he believes he can live to fight another day. But he has to beat John Kasich of Ohio, the governor there, Jeb Bush of Florida, former governor there. If he can't beat the governors who are in this other, you know, the so-called establishment wing of the party, it's hard for him to have an argument to go on. But if he, you know, he believes he wants this to be a four-man race between him, Marco Rubio, Donald Trump, and Ted Cruz. And if it's a four-man race, even if he's in fourth place in New Hampshire, he believes he can move on to fight another day.
Why do you think, and factoring Trump out for a second, as dangerous as that is, why do you think the governors in this campaign haven't made more of a difference? Governors traditionally are usually right there at the top in both parties.
I know. I don't know if it's circumstantial, that it's just the nature of the personalities who are running. There's been an argument in the Republican Party for years, particularly coming from the governors, but just in general in the mainstream of the Republican Party, that we need to nominate a governor if we want to win, and if we want to have an effective White House. And there's been an argument for so long by Republicans against Barack Obama, who is this inexperienced senator. And here you have again two guys, Cruz and Rubio, who are relatively inexperienced senators who are doing so well in these primaries. It's another confounding thing about this 2016 Republican presidential nomination contest.
Matt Katz, reporter for WNYC New York Public Radio and author of the new book, American Governor, Chris Christie's Bridge to Redemption. Matt, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Years ago today, January 25th, 2011, millions of Egyptians, fed up with the dictatorship of Hosni Mubarak, rose up and took on Egypt's establishment. The revolution led to the popular election of Mohamed Morsi, a candidate of the Muslim Brotherhood Party, a party that had been illegal until the uprising. But true democracy didn't last long. Morsi was ousted in a military coup in July of 2013, And 1 year later, General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi became president in an election that seemed to repudiate all of the promise of that wild day of change back in 2011. Mona El-Ghobashi is a lecturer in political science at Columbia University. She's written on politics and social movements in the Middle East and North Africa. She says that for Egyptians, January 25th is a moment happily past for some, and for others, there will always be a longing to return to it.
One of the great untold stories about January 25th and its political results was it inaugurated a period in Egyptian history which was probably unprecedented of both national-level democratization at the highest offices that had never been contested before, of course, primarily the presidency, but also, and this is the part that hasn't received as much attention, a growth of grassroots, what were called political committees or neighborhood committees. And these tap into a very long Egyptian tradition of local committees dating back to the 1919 uprising against the British. These two parallel tracks were working at the same time, not flawlessly and certainly not without warts, but they were working. The problem was that with the coup in July 2013, both of those very contentious but also really productive experiments in political organization were shut down. And now there are what can only be termed as stage-managed national elections and no talk, at least at the present juncture, of any kind of municipal opening elections. And even were these to be held, dictatorships are very happy to have municipal local elections to keep political competition at the local level, make sure it doesn't percolate up to the national level, which is what eventually ended up happening with January 25th.
Why did it work in Tunisia or seem to work in Tunisia and not so much in Egypt? And, of course, that's a very, you know, scaled down sense of the complexity of both places. But what's your comparison?
The first and most obvious, but not the only one, is that in Egypt there's a very politicized military and there has been cultivated much by U.S. support. So having an entrenched elite that also has all the guns and the tanks makes a huge difference. The Tunisian military from the outset, partly because of its size and partly because of its history, was not interested in blocking the democratic transition. That's the first and most obvious one. The other one is the nature of the elites in both places. The elites in Tunisia quickly realized that they'd have to make some sort of compromise with the counter elites that had never been in power. The elites in Egypt, military included, but also many civilian politicians, held out. They thought that they could actually play this scenario to their advantage. So ultimately, democracy is a struggle among competing classes and factions. And the Tunisian scenario ended up being not exactly a success story because the elites are back in power in Tunisia, but the Egyptian elites were stronger than the advocates for change.
Before Nasser rose to power in Egypt, the country was not a hugely influential player in the region. I mean, it was certainly Egypt. I mean, there was no doubting its significance, but it certainly couldn't claim to be a mover in the region. Then Nasser proved that Egypt could do that, but of course he initiated and lost a couple of wars as a result. But still, that established the power of Egypt that pretty much stayed through till Mubarak. Now that's gone. Egypt is marginalized. ISIS is more important, arguably, than Egypt is, and the Saudis' argument with Iran is a much bigger conflict in the region right now than Egypt's arguments with Hamas and Israel. Will that ever change, or where are we in that?
Egypt has become eclipsed to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is now the major regional player on several fronts. And what is interesting and new is that the Egyptian leadership under Sisi is very openly portraying itself as an adjunct and the little sister of Saudi Arabia, partly because the Egyptian leadership relies on massive funds from the Saudis. So this shift in regional significance for Egypt was almost overturned by January 25th. One of the things that was scary to many elites across the Arab world and their allies in other parts of the world was that the popular upsurge that January 5th represented would translate into foreign policy. Because if you had Egyptians participating in politics, it would mean that their preferences in foreign policy would also matter. And that's what scared many, many, many people. And so there was a potential for Egypt to regain not exactly the Nasserist bluster of Egypt as the major dominant power, but some sort of a re invigorated role and relevance. And that has been completely cast aside by the coup, again, very much with the agreement of the current Egyptian leadership under Sisi.
Would Sadat and Nasser be rolling over in their graves if they saw the situation today, or is it really not comparable?
I think they would be stunned at the way that Egypt has changed on so many fronts. Politically, I think they would be stunned by the level of popular participation that led to ultimately January 25th, because it made it seem as if Mubarak just let things out of control. And they would see a very changed country, because one of the things that is really important to remember, despite the defeat of the revolution, is that Egypt has entered a period of political struggle, open political struggle, very high stakes, that it hasn't seen since it became a republic in 1953. So this is a moment of extraordinary upheaval, and we have no idea how this is going to play out.
So there's no clear evolutionary pathway from where we are now. We're headed for another surprise moment like the 25th.
That's what 25th taught us, that because it was an accident, a historical accident, nobody saw it coming, least of all the people who actually ended up making it. It's really hard and risky to venture any kind of propositions about where we're going. We could either see yet another revolution in the making, or we could see a very long period of very strict, violent military rule.
Mona El-Kabashi is a lecturer in political science at Columbia University. She's written on politics and social movements in the Middle East and North Africa. Mona, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Happy Burns Day, folks. And there's only one thing to close your eyes and let pour over you on this day. And it's not the sound of mere bagpipes, oh humble listeners.
Fair fa' your honest sonsy face, great chief know the puddin' race. Aboon them all, you tack your place, pinch, tripe or therm.
That's Address to a Haggis by poet Robert Burns, read there by David Sibbald. Robert or Rabbi Burns, National Poet of Scotland, was born on this day in 1759, and in his honor, Burns Night is celebrated in Scotland and around the world, where the traditional Burns Supper, and indeed what is being spoken about in this poem, is the Haggis, great chieftain of the pudding race, Burns calls it, and it's like no pudding you might know. Well, it's Scotland's national dish, and while Burns Night is celebrated far and wide here in the United States, according to Richard Lockhead, Scotland's Cabinet Secretary for Rural Affairs, Food and Environment, imported haggis from Scotland has been banned since 1971.
Well, it's a real shame that Americans, be they Americans with Scottish ancestry or anyone else who's just interested in tasting good food from around the world or enjoying culture from other countries, they can enjoy the kilt, the tartan, they can enjoy the bagpipes, they can enjoy Scotch whisky and so on, but they can't enjoy the traditional Scotch haggis, particularly around Burns season when Robert Burns, Scotland's national poet, is celebrated in America, you know, the author of Auld Lang Syne. Abraham Lincoln actually, I'm told, composed a toast to Burns. So many Americans are familiar with Robert Burns, and when they celebrate it, as I said before, they can enjoy all the other Scottish icons, but it would be great if they could also just complete the picture by being able to enjoy Scottish haggis at the same time.
And there's a famous Burns poem about a haggis.
There's the Address to the Haggis. So when a Burns supper takes place, people pay tribute to Robert Burns and his works, and people recite his songs and his poems. They also usually kick off the Burns Supper with an address to the Haggis, the chieftain of the pudding race, and that always just gets things off to a great start.
Is there a legend as to like the first Scotsman who it occurred to them to take the lung and jazz it up?
It's a good question about how haggis was first developed, but following the death of our national poet Robert Burns in 1796, within a few years people started to celebrate Robert Burns. And of course, because he'd written about the haggis, then haggis featured in Burns Suppers, and the Address to the Haggis was often what kicked off the Burns Supper evening. I guess haggis is quite a traditional dish. It wouldn't be very expensive to produce in the olden days. It's very filling. And you know, you have it with vegetables and potatoes, you can have a good nutritious meal at the same time. So I guess homes across the country began to enjoy haggis at certain times of the year. It's just very satisfying to have your haggis neeps and tatties.
Is there a recipe, an official recipe for the haggis?
Well, a traditional recipe for haggis is like of sheep's liver and heart with some oatmeal and onions and seasoning and so on. Sheep lung is often in there as well, but of course that would not be allowed to go into the US, so that would have to be substituted with the other parts of the sheep meat. You know, that's why we're looking for the lamb, for sheep meat, to be allowed back into the US market. And thankfully the US government are now saying they're about to consult on that, and hopefully it's likely to happen at some point in 2016. So who knows, in 2017, that traditional recipe for haggis will be able to be exported from Scotland to the US.
Well, with the stipulation that only authentic haggis comes from Scotland, you take the sheep's lung and the liver and the heart and some oatmeal and some onions, and what do you do with it?
Well, that's it. You mix it up in a big pan, and then it goes into the oven, or you boil it, or if it's in a sheep's stomach, so it's wrapped up in the sheep's stomach or whatever. I mean, different producers will use different parts of the animal to wrap up the haggis in. You don't eat, of course, that part of it. It's just to hold it together as you're cooking it, and then you get the knife, and then you stick the knife into the haggis skin, and then you rip it open, and then the haggis steams out, and that's what, you know, is a really iconic part of the burnt supper as well, when people pipe in the haggis, the bagpiper leads in the haggis, someone delivers the address to the haggis, and at the end of it, of course, they're putting their knife into it and ripping it open.
And you got your haggis and your potatoes and your turnips, and wash it all down with a single malt.
If you want the perfect Scottish evening, or the perfect Scottish burn supper, as takes place in many, many countries around the world, that's what you want. You want the haggis and heaps of tatties, and then you wash it down with a dram of Scotch whiskey.
Richard Lockhead, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Richard Lockhead, signing out from New York.
Richard Lockhead is Scotland's Cabinet Secretary for Rural Affairs, Food and Environment. The Takeaways search for America's greatest innovation begins today with help from our partners at the American Society of Mechanical Engineers. It's a series about the stuff we've made, the stuff that has revolutionized America's culture, the economy, the way we live, the way people on the planet live. What is innovation? What does it feel like to think that way, to create that way? There is a curious unity, apparently, between the values of America and the qualities that have made for earth-shaking innovations that have transformed the 19th and 20th centuries. I'm sure you can list them. Of course you can list them. But what is this magical human quality? Americans have benefited from it, but Americans have also been trying to capture it, this inner impulse of inspiration and innovation, bottle it, and take it into the 21st century, along with people around the world trying to do the same thing, from India to Colombia to China and beyond. We want you to help us figure it out. Maybe crack the innovation code with your thoughts and votes. Saginaw, Michigan. Greatest innovation? Jazz and blues. I'll let the Ken Burns documentary make my case. Okay.
Hi, this is Rob from San Jose, California. I believe it's the light bulb. With it came the advancement of the electronic grid and the ensuing productivity.
You'll get to vote on our website and nominate a favorite crucial innovation. We'll tell you how to do all that. But first, to get us all started, we ask some people with their own resume of American ingenuity to give us their ideas. Vernon Reed, guitarist, songwriter, composer. He shares his powerful, persuasive conviction that it is the electric guitar that is, in fact, America's greatest innovation. Vernon?
Hi, this is Vernon Reed, guitarist and founding member of the band Living Color. Any conversation that talks about an innovation that's changed our world forever has to include the electric guitar. Exhibit A, Chuck Berry. Exhibit B, B.B. King. The sound, the magic, the emotion that comes out of an electric guitar has made music what it is today. And it all started right here in the United States. The guy who developed the first one was a musician named George Beauchamp, who got help from an engineer named Adolph Rickenbacker. Their problem? Guitars just weren't loud enough to fill large rooms and concert halls, so other instruments, like pianos and trumpets, took center stage. In 1931, after years of tinkering, Beauchamp and Rickenbacker debuted the world's first electric guitar. It was a small aluminum instrument meant to be played on your lap. They called it the frying pan. At first, it was Hawaiian musicians that got the most use out of the new amplified guitar. But following close behind were blues, jazz, and country artists. Then came the early rock and roll pioneers. Think Charlie Christian.
Buddy Holly. As time progressed, so did guitar players. Hendrix, Santana, Clapton, Page, Fripp. They all took the electric guitar to another level. They laid the foundation for bands like the one I started in the late 80s. We all owe a lot to Mr. Beecham and Mr. Rickenbacker. Their gift to our world paved the way for another kind of innovation, one of artistic expression, and also a countercultural movement that changed our country forever and for the better. So please, express yourself right now. Make it loud and vote for this wholly fabulous and revolutionary electric instrument. Like the late, great Frank Zappa said, shut up and play your guitar.
What do you think is America's greatest innovation? Log on to our website, thetakeaway.org, and take your pick from our list of 9 innovation nominees, or you can nominate your own innovation. The plan is to have multiple rounds of voting over the next month and eventually crown a champion. We've already heard from many of you. Reading, Pennsylvania, without question, the airplane, manned flight. Flying was a quest for human beings for thousands of years. Many had tried and failed, but 2 bicycle mechanics from Ohio took on the challenge, inventing numerous other patented technologies along the way, including the wind tunnel. Orville and Wilbur Wright built, tested, and flew an invention that changed the world and did it without corporate sponsorship or a family fortune, a feat that will never be repeated. You may get an argument about who exactly invented flight, but that's another story.
This is Gary Bremen from Wilton Manors, Florida. And in 1872, Yellowstone was established as the world's very first national park. Today, nearly 100 nations around the world have copied that idea, and the National Park Service is celebrating its centennial in 2016. It's really a great innovation and one of the best ideas America ever had.
Charlotte, North Carolina, the individual. For better or worse, prior to the creation of the United States and our adoption of the U.S. Constitution, most civilizations have had some form of caste, and the individual was part of a collective under the authority of a single person or group. Now, the idea of individuality and self-importance is spreading throughout the world. That's a good one.
My name is Alex. I'm calling from San Jose, California. The greatest invention America's ever made is the Internet. It's just so useful and so versatile. Pretty much every other invention that was made can be improved on through the Internet. So that has to be the winner.
This is Drew from LeGrand, Oregon. The greatest American innovation. Close second to the polio vaccine, but number one has to be the ShamWow from late night TV.
Hi, this is Riley from Balsam Spa, New York. The greatest invention that I think has ever been invented is the iPhone. I mean, what would I do without it, really? I'd probably be bored for countless hours.
Hey, guys. Ryan from Kelseyville, California. I say it's the coffee pot. How else can I brew up some peach coffee and listen to your great show?
I'll take some more coffee, too, Ryan. Give us a call. Tell us a story about America's greatest innovation. The number is 8778-MY-TAKE, or leave us a comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Play it, Jimi. Jimi Hendrix. The electric guitar is nominated by Vernon Reed to kick off our Greatest American Innovation series. The electric guitar is at the intersection of art, technology, and culture. It's also created something completely new in all of those places the electric guitar has. Well, this crowded intersection is where our next guests have found parking spaces. Storm Gluer and Benham Plum are both part of the Department of Music and Entertainment Industry Studies at the University of Colorado right here in Denver. Between the two of them, they have more than 20 years' experience in the music industry. And if you add my 30 years or so in the news business, we got 50 years of experience in media right here at this table. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having us.
So let's talk first of all about why the electric guitar is actually a plausible entrant in this Greatest Innovation series, because I at first thought, no, that's ridiculous. But actually, it started out as let's solve the amplification problem of guitars, and it changed everything else. That's the way innovation works, right?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes. Do you think this works? Do you think this is a good – I mean, how do you see one change having this ripple effect, and how do you study that sort of thing?
I like to look back at when Dylan went electric at the Newport Folk Festival, the crowd actually booed him. And but from that point, people started following in Dylan's lead. And you see that even in the movie about Johnny Cash, where Cash says he wants to go and make a record at a prison. And the record label was telling him, everybody's gone electric. Dylan's gone electric. You can't go make an acoustic record there. But it's funny because that has really changed the entire culture of music when people followed in that step, because he was such a great songwriter. And me coming from the publishing and songwriting point of view, that really changed things when Dylan did that. And even though the crowd didn't like it in the beginning, looking back, Dylan said it was the right thing to do.
It also changed guitar technique and the way that you could take an entire band with you in one case, which changed performance practice in many, many ways. At the University of Colorado, where you study, it's finding these kinds of combinations and intersections. That's really what you do.
Oh, certainly, certainly. And even when we look at a history from the broad standpoint of how technology has disrupted and changed the music business so much, you can look at several periods in time where we have changed the delivery of music, but yet the creation of it has stayed pretty static. You know, it still comes down to the talent and the musicianship all behind it. But we focus on not only the changes that occur in the creation of music, but how it's affected by technology, you know, especially. And Benham and I both teach courses in which we can talk about something that's happening in the music business at perhaps the beginning of the semester, and that may totally change even by the end of it.
Absolutely.
Would you say the access to that creativity, the creative element, more people are able to do creative music creation because of the technology, that's the nature of the innovation on some level?
Absolutely. I think that's one of the big things, is it's removed some of the barriers to entry for people. And the way that people can, you know, basically afford a guitar plus some music equipment, and if they've got the right team, they can make a hit record in their basement if they know what they're doing. And so that has removed the barriers to entry, because back in the day, if we're talking, you know, in the 60s and Dylan and people like that, they had to go into a legit studio and you know, get funding to do that. But now if you work hard and you save up your money, you can afford to basically build your own studio. And that has removed a lot of barriers to entry for people from our production point of view, too.
And created the pop music scene in Africa, for instance.
Yes.
You can't imagine it without the electric guitar.
Right.
And all the studios that are in, you know, garages in Ghana and Ivory Coast and all of those places that produce records.
Yes, absolutely. And you can also look at it from the consumer side. A person now has access to music they may not have had any access to previously. Mm-hmm. I joke to my students at the University of Colorado Denver that a fan of Hungarian disco can now find their their music and their fellow fans, you know, through the technology we have now.
That's
and
right.
Not only that, the Hungarian disco artist can find that group, and as Benham said, from his own basement, from his or her own basement.
Which is Looking for Sugar Man, the story, great, fantastic film about a community of listeners in South Africa connecting with a forgotten musician in the United States, impossible but for exactly the innovations you're talking about.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I love that. I remember when I was, you know, in college, and we had a gigantic stereo. It wasn't mine. It was my roommate's. It went to the ceiling. And we made an enormous amount of noise and probably reduced the grade point average of some people on the floor below us. I went back to that same place at the University of Chicago, and in that room is giant computer stuff, which indicates the change of technology. But I remember one of my roommates used to always say he didn't play an instrument, but he played the stereo. You know, that was his instrument. And I thought, oh, that's kind of a, you know, stoner thing to say. But in fact, there was something to that. I mean, people play their musical equipment in the creation of playlists, and that's a part of musical creativity that never existed before. And innovation.
Absolutely, yes.
Absolutely.
Yes, it's the mixtape on steroids.
Yeah.
Yes.
Where's this headed? Before we go, where do you think? In music and elsewhere? What's your most exciting thing to study right now before we go?
Well, I think the idea that we're shifting to a streaming economy in music is exciting yet worrisome. Benham teaches classes in music publishing, and understanding how we're going to make that economic model work and keep musicians creating is still to be determined. But I think it's exciting that it's just one further step in the unbundling of the old concept of the album. And now, as you say, people can make their own playlists and carry it with them wherever they go and have it accessible from every, you know, moment, every waking moment. And I think that's very exciting, again, from a consumer standpoint. But we've got to work out the economics to keep it going.
Yeah, it's shifting from a model from it's access versus ownership, because we used to just go to the record store and buy a record. But now we can access it wherever we want. But then on the other side of the coin, this is what we love to talk about in our classes. Adele just sold 7.5 million records in 6 weeks with no streaming whatsoever. So if you have a great record, people are still going to buy it, but it is this argument of access versus ownership.
And then there's Taylor, and then there's Bowie, who right. outdid mm-hmm. Adele by passing away. I mean, it's really, really amazing. Yeah. Well, yes. Thanks to both of you for being here. What do we call your department, your Storm Gluer Associate Professor of Music and Entertainment Industry Studies at University of Colorado, Denver, and you're an assistant professor of the same thing. What's the whole department that you're in?
Well, that is part of the College of Arts and Media. And
that's an innovation all by itself. Thanks mm-hmm. so much for mm-hmm. being here, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And here's something to take with you today. A low-tech milestone with some high-tech assistance. The first all-female crew and the first team of four to row across the Pacific came ashore in northern Australia this morning, local time. Took them 9 months, 257 days, protein bars, freeze-dried meals, and desalinated water. 9 months in the same itty-bitty boat floating in the largest body of water on Earth. That's our show for today from Denver and KUVO in Denver. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.